Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust. I'm here with my executive director, Josh Wood, of Them Before Us. And we are here to talk with you about some major trending news stories this week as it relates to children and families. Why? Because you, church, are plan A for child protection on the earth. And God wants you to instill a kingdom here in this country at this moment of time in a way that reflects his kingdom values. And his kingdom values are always going to center on valuing children, welcoming children, and protecting children. So we're going to cover a few headlines from the last week in these first two sessions, but we always kick things off with a little bit of Bible time. And today I want to talk with you. Well, I just want to actually confess that there is a verse that is well known to a lot of people that I think that I underutilize and I undervalue. And it has been in my life three different times over the last week. It's from Matthew 16. And you're probably familiar with this. Jesus is speaking and he says, "I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall have been loosed in heaven." Now, as a Christian, there are things that I am good at. I'm actually pretty good at hearing the word and obeying the word. I have a relationship with God that is kind of like a general and a foot soldier. If he tells me to go, I don't really question what he says to do. I just go. But there are things that I'm not good at in this Christian life. And one of them is devoting myself to prayer and believing that the authority that God has given me in the heavenly realms actually changes things on earth. But between reading with my son one day, reading with my daughter a couple days later, and then hearing this in a sermon, again, I thought, all right, this is obviously something I need to pay attention to. And so I kind of looked at the Jewish concept of binding and loosing. What on earth were Jesus's followers thinking when he was talking about binding and loosing? And this is a concept in Judaism, rabbinic Judaism, that binding means to forbid something, and to loose something means to permit it. So it has to do with genuinely spiritually forbidding or spiritually permitting things to take place. It's that kind of authority. It was generally exercised by the Sanhedrin in Jesus's time. And so what Jesus was saying to his followers is, you don't just have the authority to enact, permit, or restrict certain behaviors on earth. You've got the power in heavenly realms, and it's not relegated to a handful of leaders kind of walking around among you. It's available to the priesthood of all believers. So I'm going to stop there, but just to say that I was very convicted this week that I do not tap into the spiritual power that I think God has generously granted to all believers. And this is a really timely reminder for me because at Them Before Us, the nonprofit that centers on advancing the rights of children in matters of marriage and family, we are devising several projects and initiatives that are going to take on not just some of the greatest earthly forces that are seeking to dismantle family and children and marriage, but the heavenly forces that would love to see the kingdom of God defeated by destroying the object lesson, marriage, that God gave to represent his relationship to his own bride, the church. So I'll tell you what, in the coming weeks, I am going to be doing a better job of binding and loosing in heaven for the sake of the tasks that I feel like God has put before us as defenders of children at Them Before Us. Josh, thoughts on binding and loosing? And do you bind and loose as a regular practice?
I think that we all do because of Christ's example. When Christ did this and he talked about binding and loosing the law, it was things like, should we heal on the Sabbath? And is it wrong to eat the grain on the Sabbath when your followers are hungry and you need to pick heads of grain to eat them? So What I take that to mean is God saying the law was not meant to oppress people. And as systems and things change, we as Christians do have to constantly take God's ideals and his intentions, and we have to now take those into everyday life. And it's, for example, when Christ healed someone on the Sabbath, well, are you really telling me the law forbids us from showing compassion and care to those, someone because it's the Sabbath? No. But Christ is saying, we have the opportunity here. We bind and loose the law to uphold the spirit of the law too. And so I do think we're rational creatures. God gives us these brains for a reason. And in our world of defending children, there is no shortage of ways that people have come up with new, innovative technologies to dismantle the family. And so it's absolutely our job to not allow people to hide behind, you know, language and hide behind compassion or rights to actually end up oppressing people. We have to be interpreters to show this is how the law applies in this context. And we're going to stand up for kids. We're going to defend God's design for family. Even when we all know it, culture is so good at changing and twisting words to make evil sound good. But we have to be the people who are doing the binding and loosing, saying, no, that's not what that means. This is what God meant. This is how we apply it in this context.
Yeah, we need his kingdom to come. We need his will to be done in the United States, in Seattle, in North Carolina, on earth as it is in heaven. And one of the ways that we feel like at Them Before Us, there is the greatest amount of confusion, cowardice, and just apathy is as it relates to laws around children. So that is why we focus on it. That's one of the reasons why we make this an emphasis. There's a lot of big battles happening in the world right now. This is the place where we feel like the church is not stepping up the way that they should. This is where we really do need to bring the kingdom of God. We need to bind and loose those spiritual forces on behalf of protection for the most vulnerable. Well, we saw the unraveling of some of those protections take place in Louisiana this week. At Them Before Us, we do a lot of work on reproductive technologies, IVF, sperm and egg donation, surrogacy, especially because very few people in the church, unless you're Catholic, are talking about this. And so we try to say, hey, church, this is not something that you are allowed to be neutral on. This is actually something where there's a lot of biblical support for taking a clear stand on behalf of protecting children's right to life, children's right to their mother and father. And all of that needs to be the lens through which we view laws about IVF or surrogacy or sperm or egg donation. And over the past couple decades, we've been able to point at Louisiana as being a pretty good example of a state that's trying to do it right, trying to allow for adults to avail themselves to reproductive technologies, but valuing the personhood, valuing the rights of these tiny humans in the form of embryos created in a laboratory and often stored in frozen containers while they await their chance at implantation. So Louisiana has sort of been the one bright spot on the U.S. map as it relates to reproductive technologies. But this past week, they unfortunately passed a bill sponsored by Senator Presley, who typically is a pro-life champion, that rolled back a lot of the protections for unborn children in the form of frozen embryos. So Josh, can you give us a little overview about what happened in Louisiana this week?
Well, we should probably start with saying it was extremely disappointing. Louisiana has been almost a shining example, proving for 50 years that the IVF industry, despite their desires to fearmonger, could operate when a state put in place regulations that protect children. And Louisiana had that. They had personhood laws. And unfortunately, this all kind of started with the Alabama Supreme Court when it ruled that embryos destroyed due to clinical negligence are human lives and that the clinic in question was liable under the Wrongful Death of a Minor Act. Everything changed after that. Clinics began to hold embryos hostage. There was this fear among parents that now my embryos might be in danger. People might take them away from me. And clinics, I think, preyed on that to some degree, sending out letters saying, we're not touching them until these laws change. And now you've seen a rush in very conservative states. Again, states that have gotten it right consistently. You've seen them rush to pass laws that have really changed the game. You know, for 50 years, we said Louisiana was the only state that had laws protecting those created via IVF. And now we've seen that rolled back through this bill. This bill limits liability for IVF clinics and embryo transport companies. We're basically seeing the license given to these practitioners to treat human life as if it is not, to limit the liability they have when those embryos are harmed. And what that will lead to, again, when states see even great states like Louisiana do this, it gives them permission to do the same, thinking, man, if they're doing it, it can't be that bad. This person who passed the bill, Presley, he's a pro-life person. Man, Katie, it makes me think, is it that they don't know? Do they not understand? If we can't trust them to be experts, man, what kind of work do we have to do to educate people on this practice to understand how it's harming children?
I think the big problem here is kids don't vote, and frozen embryos can't donate to political campaigns. And so there really is a pressure on even supposedly pro-family, pro-life policymakers to bend to their constituency. And within the Christian world, within the conservative world, there are certainly a lot of people that are availing themselves to these reproductive technologies, often because they are experiencing genuine infertility and they long to be parents. Now, we should validate that desire to bring children into this world, but it cannot be at the expense of children's right to life. It cannot be at the cost of a million to maybe 10 million babies on ice in this country, many of which have been abandoned. There's nobody like paying for their storage fee anymore. It cannot be at the expense of children who are discarded or donated to research. It cannot be at the expense of children who are handed over or tossed aside to be donated to another couple if there's surplus embryos. So I honestly think that it's great to have convictions. But it's very, very rare to find somebody who is going to act on those principles, even if it goes against the people who might be supporting their campaign. Adults support campaigns. Babies, especially frozen embryos, cannot.
They say it's not a principle till it costs you money. And I do think push has come to shove in a lot of these ways, even as people do understand what's happening. This bill specifically replaced adoption for embryos, because if it's a person, and you're going to transfer that person to someone else? Well, our states make pathways for that. It's called adoption. It's a child-centric institution that vets the parents. You're not owed an embryo. We're going to vet you. Well, now we've rolled that back to now being donated. And there's this schizophrenia in the law because they call it a person still, but then they say you can donate the person. I mean, this is... We have got to work out, are you in or out? Is it a person or is it not? Because if it's a person, you can't donate people.
Yeah, there are very, very clear contradictions between the world of big fertility and the world of adoption, especially. And that's one of the ways that I think we've been able to open the eyes to the abuses of the big fertility industry is by talking about how, hey, everything that they do, it runs afoul. It actually is the actual inverse of what we've been practicing in the world of adoption, which I think a lot of people understand. A lot of people understand sometimes kids cannot be raised by their mother and father. Adoption is a just society's response. But in adoption, we do not pay people to relinquish their parental rights. We do that in big fertility all the time. That's what you're doing when you buy sperm or egg. You're paying that person to stay out of the child's life forever. In adoption, an adult who wants a kid has to go through rigorous screenings and background checks and home studies. In the world of big fertility, the child often goes home with one or two unrelated adults, and there's no screening or vetting or background checks. In the world of adoption, not every adult who wants a kid is going to get one. But hopefully every child that needs a family will be placed in a loving home. In the world of big fertility, every adult will get a child as long as they have a bottomless pit of money to spend, regardless of whether or not they've got a criminal background or are a child predator. So we want to highlight how these laws victimize children, and we want to raise up a generation of genuinely principled adults who are going to speak out on their behalf, even if it costs them money, costs them personally, because that is what Christian justice requires. Stay with us. We'll be back with more headlines.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
We're back at Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, joined by my executive director, Josh Wood, of Them Before Us, the place where we put them, the children, before us, the adults, because that is what a just society looks like. A just society is going to insist that adults sacrifice for children and not the other way around. That needs to happen in every area of our lives. When we're talking about marriage, when we're talking about parenthood, when we're talking about our own decisions leading up to marriage and parenthood, and even the kind of relationship that we have with our spouse, kids or not, are then going to redound to the other people in our household, current or future. And on that topic, we are going to talk about five reasons why porn is bad for your marriage. Now, this may not be a big surprise that you don't necessarily want people addicted to porn or using porn outside of a marriage, but actually, use of pornography within marriage is pretty common. So we're going to talk about a summary, an article from the Institute for Family Studies, identifying the data around five specific harms of using porn in your marriage. Josh, do you want to jump in here? Are you surprised to hear that a lot of married couples are using porn, even within marriage?
Well, so Katie, I want to start asking you a question. Do you think that this includes kind of this rising romance novel, extremely graphically sexual content that is very popular in female circles? Because what I'm tempted to say is, everyone kind of just puts this at the feet of men, which I don't doubt that they consume more, and it's awful, an epidemic. But do you think that they're taking into account some of these, I don't know what you call them, romance novels, where they're graphically explaining sexual situations? And I mean, I think it's pretty popular among college women and high school girls as well. What's your take?
Okay, so obviously men, when it comes to the sexual act, are much more visually wired. And that is why pornography, online pornography, is much more of a snare for men. When it comes to sexual intimacy, women are more emotionally wired. And that is why their porn of choice is romantic or like young adult romance fiction, kind of things like that. And I used to joke with my daughters because they love reading. Like all young girls, well, most young girls really love reading, and they'll pick up these multi-series books. And I will tell you, like, I would pick it up and I would flip 3/4 of the way through and read a few pages, and I could find the sex scene. And very often it was not a spelling everything out in detail like porn. Porn very much focuses just on the penetrative aspect of sex. There's not a lot of lead up. Men generally don't need quite as much lead up or backstory. Women need 3/4 of a book of backstory and lead up. And then it would get to the point where there was a sexual encounter and they wouldn't describe the whole thing in detail, but it would be enough for arousal. So yes, this is the kind of material that women respond to more. But there are a lot of women that are looking at porn as well. I think that, you know, not this study, but other studies that I've looked at have put the number at over 90% for men, but close to 60% of women actually watching online porn. The kind of porn differs. Men tend to watch porn that is a little more violent, a little more graphic. Women tend to watch softer porn or porn that does not involve as much sort of sadomasochism, violence, aggression, but it's still used. Some women will use it as a way to generate arousal before sex. So I do know, I've heard of couples that have used this in their marriage, like foreplay. So this study talks about why that's damaging, whether it's one person, the guy, for example, watching it solo, or whether the couple is watching it together. So Josh, can you list some of these reasons why the researchers at the Institute for Family Studies pointed out that porn actually can be damaging to the marital relationship?
Well, the top five reasons why they should abstain as a couple or individually is that porn lowers your sexual satisfaction with your spouse, often leads to deception, including private viewing, because sometimes it gets painted by the media as couples doing it together, often leads to private viewing. Porn erodes commitment. Porn is addictive and can become an obsession. Studies have linked porn use with an increase in depression, especially among those who consume it as teenagers and young adults. And porn use is shown to increase the likelihood of divorce. I'll say just in my experience, I have seen it be really, really bad for couples. I cannot think of a single time where anyone has ever told me it livened up their sex life or made things better. And I will say, Katie, it's only gotten worse as it's lived in our pockets. It's all free. And it's getting younger. I mean, I feel like, the videos, there's obsessions with younger people being depicted, and the people consuming it are getting younger. I think all of this is terrible for relationships and marriage.
If you understand the power of sex and the function of sex, primarily in a marriage relationship, but sex is going to do things to you whether you want it to or not. There's no such thing as casual sex. Your body always takes it seriously. Your mind always takes it seriously. When we understand the nature of sex, these five harms are not going to be any surprise to us at all. So porn lowers your sexual satisfaction with your spouse? Correct. Because what is it that you're doing with sex? You are bonding, right? What sex is, it's an act of bonding sexually, physically, obviously, but emotionally. You're also bonding with whoever it is you're having that sexual encounter with. And so if you are bonding sexually with something on a screen, it is going to lower your sexual satisfaction to your spouse. That object is now going to be the object of your arousal. And there's a real good chance your wife is going to be disappointing after you are watching, women who are not acting like women, right, or don't necessarily look like women if they are meeting your needs for sexual connection.
I've even seen, really unfortunately, but I've even heard of cases where dads have become sexually attracted to their daughters because the types of, I mean, it's that kind of horror show. I think that tells you what this is where this unfettered freedom, where people talk about the need to let the sexual expression of adults trump everything. Well, I think we need to take a step back and go, we should be questioning whether this is good for society at all. Not just 12-year-olds, not just 18-year-olds, not just 25, not 40-year-olds. We should be saying, is this the type of world we want to live in? Where this type of thing is happening, where women are commercialized, and women and men are commercialized, where people are addicted, where it's everywhere. Is this good? And I don't see a positive benefit to society other than that some people make, they'll say it grows the economy. I mean, come on, is that the type of world we want to live in?
Yeah. Well, over a dozen states have declared pornography a public health crisis, and for good reason. The impact that it has specifically on men, especially if they start early, it actually demotivates them. It makes them more socially hesitant, right? It's harder for them to engage with anybody in the real world. Porn actually functions as a bit of a medicant, like it medicates you if you're feeling anxious, if you're feeling lonely. It can be the thing that you go to, kind of turn to sort of medicate, make yourself feel better. There's a movement among young men to quit porn. And many of the guys that go through this report that they, within a month or two of being off of it, they felt clarity of mind. They felt renewed motivation and drive, because so much of the porn addiction and the porn use was actually sucking, was actually draining them of a lot of the virility that they would have been able to put towards things like work or school or study or projects or hobbies. And this is just, it's just outside of the natural wiring of men. Yes, men tend to be have a higher sex drive. They tend to be more flexible on sexual boundaries, but they've never before in the history of our species had this kind of unlimited access to this many virtual or even sometimes physical partners. And that has not boded well for men's developmental outcomes or their mental or emotional outcomes. And it certainly does not help them encounter real life women, even if those real life women are their wives.
Well, I think even just on a real practical level, it just creates just this alternate world of expectations where not only, I mean, we read that today's college students, a third of the women reported being choked in their most recent sexual encounter. That is purely a product of pornography, glorifying violent sexual encounters. You're creating in the minds and linking to their deep in their brains that this is good, this is right, you need this. I mean, if we don't think that there's just some manipulation going on towards some of these behaviors, we're wrong. And again, we just got to ask ourselves, is this a type of world that we want to live in? And I think that we should have the power to say, no, I don't want pornography in my community. I don't want it accessible. I don't want my 12-year-old seeing it in their pocket. Like, I want to see a movement where we put our foot down and say, this isn't good for anybody. It's not good for kids. It's not good for marriages. And we want it out.
Yeah. Well, whether or not it's manipulation, it's definitely conditioning. We are conditioning children to think about sex in certain ways, especially that it involves violence or degradation, that, you know, what you behold, you become. And what people are beholding through porn is not a real, accurate, holistic, and certainly not healthy depiction of sex. And so we are getting a generation of children, especially, that are being raised on a depiction of sex through porn that is degrading, that is violent, that is dehumanizing. And that's the kind of sex that kids are now having in the real world, or avoiding real world sex altogether. It's really scary. And you're exactly right. We should be fighting this on all levels, not just for kids. If we had our way, we would ban it for everyone. Mm-hmm. We're going to turn our attention to a Supreme Court decision this week where they declined to hear a case that had the possibility of coming before them. And you probably heard about this, but there was a school in Massachusetts, a middle school, that actively promoted LGBTQ education and encouraged students to wear clothing with positive messages about homosexuality and gender identification. So they were saying, obviously, it's so funny because you'll have people say, well, I don't think that we should have religious indoctrination in schools. I don't think that we should allow charter schools that are religious to be recognized as official options for state funding because those are religious schools. But then you've got this school in Wisconsin that is very clearly operating as a religious school. They are promoting a specific worldview about the female or the male body, about sex, about marriage, about family, about the nature of humans, right? They are promoting a religious message. They're doing it under the name of secularism or progressivism. But make no mistake, they are promoting a religious worldview. And their religious worldview was one that normalized homosexuality and transgender identities. So, this kid, who I've never met, but I love, decided to wear a shirt to his school. And the shirt said, "There are only two genders." Let me just say, in 30 years, can this kid run for president? And hats off to the parents, because I am all about, raising kids that buck the trend in public schools. And I know that it's costly for the kid, but it takes a lot of work to get your kid to the point where they are willing to go against the consensus of not just their teachers, but his friends as well. And he's like, you know what? No, I'm not going to be the unpaid advertisement for your worldview that directly conflicts with what I believe. So he goes, and he doesn't even say, "You guys are totally wrong." He wears a shirt that says, "There are only two genders." And of course, the school sues him. They don't sue him. They say, "You cannot wear that." And then Alliance Defending Freedom comes in and they're like, "Actually, he has a right to express himself and say what he wants to say. And that includes wearing the t-shirt." So that went up to the possibility of the Supreme Court, and the court declined to hear the case, which we say is a major bummer. Josh, what do you think about a kid absolutely saying, "I will not comply"?
Well, I think our education efforts, we have to focus on the fact that if teaching kids when life begins, what constitutes a life, what makes a male, what makes a female, what those roles are, how you can change. If we are ceding that to this weird category of, well, that's not religious, that's just what we need to teach people to be good citizens. This is just secularism, and we have to teach this to promote unity. If that's not religious, what? Tell me what becomes religious? What is religious anymore? can't talk about marriage, can't talk about your body, can't talk about life, can't talk, well, then we're giving away the whole game here. And so in my estimation, with this issue right here, we have to say, oh, hold on. If you can say that, if you can teach that, if you can make them wear those shirts, then we can, on the same end, we can talk about what we believe to be our worldview. And you're not allowed to cry religious foul anytime they wear them.
Yeah. And Justice Thomas and Alito, obviously, the faves, my faves on the court, they're like, yeah, I wish that we were taking up this case. You know, we're dissenting on the decline to hear this case. And clearly said, Alito said, we should affirm the bedrock principle that a school may not engage in viewpoint discrimination when it regulates student speech. And you know what blows me away is it's not like all of these different viewpoints have equal merit. One of them is true, and the others are patently false. And so they weren't just saying everybody has a right to say what they want. They actually are shutting down the viewpoint that is objectively true. So yay, Alito. Justice Thomas also dissented. You know, they said that cherry picking which First Amendment principle it thought worthy of allowing to go through the schoolhouse gates is not appropriate. I just am like, okay, we've got to pray for the court. So much of the legislative overreach, of the blurring of the lines between the three branches, has got to be figured out if we're going to have a functional republic and if we are going to defend the principles of the Constitution. We need originalist judges. We need people that are not viewing the Constitution as a living document so they can advance a political aim. We need people to be grounded in those first principles, those natural rights that are going to apply to everybody and protect the freedoms, the prosperity that has led us to have not only a flourishing nation, but a nation that values and protects kids.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Welcome to the final segment of Them Before Us Radio. I'm so grateful that you give us an hour of your time on the weekend. Hopefully you're also outside gardening or you're in the car driving to a kid volleyball match or a soccer game or something. But I'm just grateful that you're making us a part of your weekend, especially because your attention is precious. And I'm so thankful that you're giving your attention to these matters that have to do with child protection and family flourishing. We talk about an awful lot here, obviously, reproductive technologies, as you heard in the first segment, pornography. You know, we represented the rights of children in an amicus brief that was encouraging and upholding, working to uphold age verification laws in pornography laws, and that's pretty critical to child protection. We're going to talk a lot here about how do you parent well? How can you make sure that you are protecting the children in your own world? So at Them Before Us, we are working to defend children in the personal and in the political. We are working to defend kids in the culture and in the courtroom, and we'd love your help with that. We have an annual campaign that runs between Mother's Day and Father's Day. It's called And Not Or, because children need their mother and father, not their mother or father, their mother and father. And right now, we have a really incredible gift that's been made available to us. Every new monthly donor that we bring in during our And Not Or campaign, we will get $1,000, just $1,000 for any monthly donor, whether you're giving $5 a month, $50 a month, $500 a month. And I'll tell you what, we're going to wring every penny dry as we work to defend kids. So if you appreciate what you hear at Them Before Us Radio, if you want to get back in the game as it relates to having courageous, proactive work to defend children and families, Them Before Us is for you. And we would love to have you be a part of our team. Go to thembeforeus.com, check out our And Not Or campaign. And I'm asking you to become a monthly supporter. It will help us make sure that we can continue to defend kids in this realm where very few people are speaking up on their behalf. Well, during the last segment of Them Before Us Radio, we take your questions. And I've got my training director, Jen Friesen, here, who has done a good job of scouring the internet and receiving emails and messages from you during the week so that we can do exactly that. So welcome back, Jen.
Hi, Katie. This one was really interesting. It's a kid asking everyone a question. And then, so I have a question for you off of this kid's question, but this kid asked, I have almost no memories of my parents asking me real questions about my life, unless they really, really had to, my struggles, how I was feeling inside, how to make my life better, etc. Instead, I was the one who listened to my mother's realest stuff, like her work, relationship with family, complaining about my father, her friends, etc. The kid's question was, did your parents ask you real questions? And my question for you is, a parent reading that would probably feel pretty sad or wonder, do I ask my kids real questions? Am I using my kid as a sounding board for my problems, or am I able to get to know them? So what would your advice be for how we can get to know our kids better as they're growing up, staying close to them, staying invested with important questions?
Well, it's interesting because my first thought is this kid is being raised by a single mother, because I actually hear that. You'll hear that from children of single mothers. And we've actually like studied that kids who grow up with a woman, with a mom who's not married, they will become her primary person. Like she'll start to treat them like a spouse or like a best friend because she needs that kind of like close proximity person with whom she can process or pour out or like bear her emotional burdens. And that's exactly why there's supposed to be two adults in the relationship, because the mother and the father should be able to do that for each other. The mom's burdens, her work struggles, her personal challenges, those are real, but they don't belong on the shoulders of the kid. And so it's actually a pretty well-known dynamic for children of single mothers to, in essence, like little boys, to kind of become their mom's kind of emotional husband in some ways. I've unfortunately seen this in the life of some single mom friends of mine who had one child, and then kind of the child grew up, and then like strangely she happened to have another child 10 years later, and it's as if she's just looking at creating that ongoing emotional support for her. And I've seen the dynamic between her and her son, and it's not just maternal. It's like she really needs him to love and understand her and support her. And I'm like, girl, you need a husband. You don't need multiple boys in your life. You need a husband. So I don't know if that was the situation. It sounds like if the dad was in the picture, he wasn't asking these questions either. Me personally, I feel like my parents were super emotionally dialed in. And I will often say that a lot of the things I do well as a mom, I do because that's how my mom parented me. And they were very emotionally healthy in terms of really trying to get the core of what I needed, not just surface level things, really trying to understand who I was. And I think that I carried that over into my own kind of parenting life. But it is a good opportunity for parents to assess, am I really emotionally dialed in with my kids? Because honestly, when your kids are like 10 and younger or 12 and younger, you're going to be able to get most of what you need out of them, out of just rules and compliance and rewards and punishment. Once they get to be teenagers, that doesn't work anymore. At that point, you are going to have to motor along based on the emotional trust, the emotional bond, and the emotional connection that you have. And you're going to cultivate that through clearing away sort of surface level questions or surface level conversations and getting to the heart of who are you? What are you struggling with? What are you worried about? What are you hopeful for? What really matters to you most in life? And I'm not saying that you should be therapy king or queen to your kids all the time, but getting beneath the surface while your kids are growing is pretty critical as it relates to a long-term healthy connection with them.
Yeah, that's so good. I like even the simple questions of what was your favorite part of your day, your least favorite part of your day? What's something you're excited about right now? What's something you're dreading or that's really challenging you, that get to more aspirational feelings? How's your day? Fine. How's your day? Fine. Kind of thing. You know, you can ask more interesting questions and get to know people that way. Okay. Question number two. My husband and I have two kids and are done having more after three tough pregnancies. My sister, who can't have kids, asked me to be a surrogate using my egg and her husband's sperm. I said no. And now she, her husband, and our mom are calling me selfish. They refuse to adopt because they want to be there from birth on. Am I a jerk or am I in the wrong?
Okay. Interesting that they don't want to adopt. Why don't they want to adopt? Well, because they recognize that there's something special about biology. There's something special about having that child with you as early as possible. And in the sister's perspective, she's not going to be able to do that from the moment of pregnancy. So at least she should be able to do it from the moment of birth. And so right there, you already have this recognition that that biology, that biological bond, that that really matters. But it doesn't matter enough for them to say, maybe we shouldn't be pursuing this. It only matters enough as it relates to justifying what the adults want. So I think right there, we're seeing that this sort of split, and this is something we observe quite a bit in our work at Them Before Us, especially as it relates to reproductive technologies, that the barometer for what is a success or what actually is something that we could look at and say, okay, look, we've achieved the right goals here, is whether or not the adults are happy at the end of the process. So right now, the only barometer for whether or not this is a good idea is, does the sister want it? The child is going to be harmed through this because they're going to lose a relationship with their birth mother. Her sister is going to be harmed by this because surrogate pregnancies are high-risk pregnancies, and it sounds like she's already older and it's already had some difficult pregnancies. So this really could be a medical risk for her sister, the one that would be carrying the child. But their metric for understanding whether or not this should or should not happen is the sister's desires and satisfaction. That is it. So you're not wrong. You are totally right. Plant your feet firmly. Don't give an inch. I would say give them a copy of Them Before Us, Why We Need a Global Children's Rights Movement, our first book, talking about the importance of maternal bonds, the importance of mothers and fathers, the importance of biological connection. Encourage them to help them see this from the perspective of the child, and then wait for them to come around, but don't move.
Well, it's hard because there might, depending on how well she knows our material, she might feel it's wrong or not want to do it for totally legitimate reasons she can't articulate back. And, you know, if you're just saying, I don't want to do it because I don't want to do it, honestly, that's a good enough reason in this kind of scenario, because it's a very strange thing to ask. But how much more powerful if you say, no, it's a violation of a child's rights, and here's all the reasons it's not a good thing to do.
Great. Yeah, that's a great point. Like, you actually have an opportunity to educate and open their eyes to the fact that there's a lot more involved here than just what adults want. There actual is fundamental rights and well-being questions about the child. And going into this already, before the child's even conceived, before the child's even created in the lab, if you go into that already saying, they exist for me, that's not a great way to start parenthood out.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Final question. When we posted, or really anytime we post a picture of a same-sex couple, we will say, you know, what do you see when you see here? Or this is a picture of child loss. Or I think a recent post, you said gay marriage brought this about, right? Because we're saying gay marriage was sort of the pinnacle point of that slippery slope, where now we've descended down into all these technologies being used to violate the rights of children. But we posted that recently, a picture of two, you know, gay men posing in a hospital bed with a baby doing skin to skin. They've used a surrogate. And so many comments on Facebook, interestingly enough, that was where we got all the negative comments, over and over and over. Congratulations. All I see is two loving parents. Like, that was the, to them, that's all they see. And that's a good enough reason to discount anything else we say about it. So how do we respond to when someone's looking at a picture of same-sex parents? They say, well, it's two loving parents. That's all that matters. And that's what we see there.
Well, you could definitely begin with, what do you mean by love? What do you mean by love? You know, the kind of classical philosophical definition of love, a la Aristotle, was willing the good of the other. So love at its heart is selfless. You're willing the good of the other. And anytime you are creating a child that is going to lose their mother or father, often through the process of destroying other children's right to life, you are not willing the good of the other. You are willing the good of yourself. So when you say, all I see is two loving parents, from that definition, neither adult is loving. Now, maybe what you're talking about is two adults that are going to be able to change diapers and have a college savings fund and make sure that they have you know, food to eat and a roof over the head. And maybe even have some genuine fatherly affection for the child. So is that what you mean by love? In which case, yeah, sure. The child might receive a lot of those benefits. But loving parents do not starve children of some of the things that the child needs for the sake of developmental advantages and just a loving upbringing. And that always is going to involve a male and a female parent. You know, at Them Before Us, we often talk about how there's three staples of a child's social emotional diet, three things that they need a daily dose of every single day if they are going to grow up, to thrive, to be healthy, to be developmentally balanced, to certainly have access to their biological identity. What are those three things? Mother's love, father's love, and stability. Anytime any one of those three things are missing, you've got a kid that's emotionally malnourished. You have a child that is not going to be as stable. You have a child that's going to be developmentally disadvantaged. For example, there was a TikTok that, you know, was screenshotted and sent to us of a woman in a lesbian relationship who was talking about how she was left alone with just her 11-month-old daughter. And she's like, I don't talk to my daughter, and she doesn't talk yet. And is that weird that I don't? And here she is obviously talking to a phone, talking to TikTok all the time. I think she has an entire account about being, you know, in a lesbian family. So she can talk to the internet all day, but she doesn't talk to her own kid. And the 11-month-old is not talking yet. I'm like, okay, there's a developmental disadvantage going on here. That child might have two loving parents in the sense that, you know, college savings fund, roof over their head, you know, a nice high chair. When the child does not have a dad in their life, fathers actually bring a pretty critical element to language development that moms don't bring. Dads always use bigger words. Moms simplify their language right down to the child's level. So children that have a father actually talk earlier, talk better, talk sooner, and have better cognitive development. So is it loving to create a child that is always going to be deprived of either the maternal or the paternal love? I would say no. So you can always bring this back to the child, their right to life, their right to their mother and father, the complementary distinct benefits of a male and a female parent, and say, sometimes kids don't have that through tragedy. But creating that intentionally is not loving. What would you say, Jen?
Well, I agree with everything you're saying, obviously, and very well said, not just because you pay me, but you know, it made me wonder, if we could, you know, just have all the studies we want and get everything published that we want, what would the brain scans look like of a kid being raised traditionally, or we would say, you know, being raised ideally, married, bio, mom and dad in the home, compared to the brain scans of children being raised by single parents, single by choice or not? But at least we can acknowledge there's many single parents that are doing the right thing and defending children, but there's some that have intentionally done this. Compared to same-sex parents, I wonder, are they missing crucial things in that development you could see in the brain?
Ah, man. If I could have all the data that I wanted, do you know how much data I would have? A lot of people are saying, well, what are the comparisons between children raised by same-sex couples created through sperm or egg donation and children raised by same-sex couples that were adopted? Where are those studies? And we're like, yes, wouldn't that be nice? Strangely, the sociologists kind of lost interest when it came to family structure after they got gay marriage. So we don't have a whole lot of studies on family structure in the past 10 years. We should return to that. The problem is they won't, because those studies always prove the superiority of the natural family. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.